My name is Ashley Ortega, class of 2022, and this is my podcast, Hooked on Cola. It is here that we explore the College of Liberal Arts and the majors the university has to offer. You'll hear from professors, department chairs, and current students who are sharing their personal experiences here at the 40 Acres. Longhorn Band, play me out. Today, I have with me Sarah Roberts and Dr. Sean Gerd, and we are going to be talking about classics today. So, Sean, would you mind telling me a little bit about the classics department and especially what makes it unique here at UT Austin?
Absolutely. So, classics is it's the place you go to study ancient Latin and Greek. And really anything having to do with ancient and Latin Greek. So we collaborate with other departments that study other ancient cultures, but we are ancient Rome, ancient Greece, anywhere there were either Latin speakers or Greek speakers in the ancient world. That's what we do. And we do it from every imaginable perspective. So we have archaeologists, we have ancient historians, we have people who study poetry, I study music, theater. It's the whole, like, if it happened in principle, you can learn about it from us. I think the other thing that's interesting about our department is that we have all kinds of different methodologies. So we have people who work on DNA with ancient remains, and then I play ancient instruments as part of my research. So it's like a wide range of methods and questions and approaches.
And how long have you been here at UT?
3 years.
3 years. And what was kind of the attraction to the University of Texas?
So UT Classics is a top program. It's one of the best in the country. And I was just really excited about being at a place where research was important, where teaching was of a very high quality, and where students were excellent. And students here are truly excellent, just an absolute joy to teach. And so, yeah, it was easy. It was an easy decision.
Absolutely an easy decision to come to UT. And Sarah, so why did you choose classics as a major?
I chose classics because I originally was really into history, and that was sort of like my passion in high school. But the language I chose in high school was Latin. And so that led me into Roman history. But mainly it was the community around that Latin class. So we would do these like area meetings through like the Junior Classical League. And as Dr. Gerd described, there's just anything you can explore. There's people there playing ancient instruments, and there's people there dressing up in togas and reciting ancient plays. And so I wanted to continue to learn more about the discipline in any way possible. And so it's just endlessly fascinating. And that's why I kind of decided to pursue classics.
Very nice. And I understand that you are very involved in the Classics Organization Club Group here at UT. Would you mind telling us a little bit about that?
Yes. So the club we have here at UT, we call it Eta Sigma Phi, but it's the like Classics Club, and we have meetings every other Thursday. And so you can come even if you aren't part of the official Eta Sigma Phi. It's very open just to anybody who's interested in classics, wants to learn more, and wants to get involved. And we host classics-related events, but they're very fun and lighthearted. So for instance, this evening we're having a watch party for the new Percy Jackson, because it's kind of an ongoing joke that many of us were inspired to study classics because we grew up reading Percy Jackson. But we also do more scholarly things, like we have picnics with professors where we'll invite a professor out and we'll all have a dinner together, and they can talk to us about what they study and what their research is on. So if anybody's interested in pursuing it as a career, they can learn about what their options are and things like that. So it's a great opportunity if you're just interested in classics as like a side passion, or if it's what you want to do as a career one day, you can come join the club and sort of explore all those avenues.
Awesome. Definitely wish I knew that was around whenever I was a student here.
I think that's a very common experience, is that the community in the department is really warm and really welcoming. There's a lot going on, and I think it's fun to be in the department. I mean, it's a great subject to study, but there's a lot of just value in having a community that's not huge. We're not a tiny program. We're actually quite large in comparison with other classics departments in the U.S., but it's small enough that people know each other, and I think you mostly get along, and there's a lot of socializing, and it's a good vibe. It's a cool hang.
Cool hang.
Yes, that's one of my favorite things about it, is just if you're in Wagner Hall, you're going to see somebody you know, and it's just this warm, inviting community. I remember on my first day here in Latin, we had the introduction survey to fill out, and my Latin teacher, who was a graduate student named Bill Ferris, he saw that I wanted to do archaeology, and he immediately got me into contact with archaeologists in the department. So it's just like a great place to have a community that's going to support you.
And I think that's something that's really, really unique about UT, is thinking about like the size of our university. We are large, but we work very hard to instill that sense of community and belonging. And I think that's definitely something where UT excels and stands out for sure. And then some of the information you sent over to me was about the archaeological dig in Histria in Romania. Is that something that you would like to elaborate on and give us a deeper insight or understanding?
Sure. So that particular dig, that's run by Dr. Rabinowitz, Adam Rabinowitz, and it's in an interesting part of the world. So it's not like downtown ancient Greece, right? Downtown ancient Greece would be Athens, Sparta. We think of these places, some of the islands in the Aegean. The west coast of Turkey was also heavily populated by Greek speakers, and there were quite a lot of quite wealthy cities there. Histria is in Romania and is an area, so it's not central. It's also an area where there were lots of other speakers, language speakers living, and there's population movement through that area over a long period of time. And so you have a kind of a non-central, multicultural, multi-historical area. And then when you do archaeology on an ancient place, you don't just get a single time. You go down and this oversimplifies, but in simple terms, as you go down, you discover different times. So you kind of get different strata representing different historical periods. So you can do long-term historical narratives in a tiny little area. You go down and you know how to look and you use the right tools and you do the right kind of testing. And one of the things that Adam is interested in is how an area which dealt with lots of change, significant upheaval of a historical nature, remained resilient. So something happens, there's a fire or somebody invades, and the community continues somehow. How does the community continue to be resilient? And part of that, one of the factors that really lots of people are studying in all kinds of parts of the world, is climate. So climate change, I think many archaeologists and anthropologists would now agree that climate change can be a driver of cultural change, and you can see that in the archaeological record. It's harder to see it in other forms of evidence because we don't have you need long strips of time before you can see that kind of, like, climate change is slow, right? It doesn't happen overnight. And so you need enough of a chronology to be able to see that change, and then you need to be able to measure other things. So for literature, which is really only a 2,000-year-old story, we can see a bit of it, but we don't get a really big story that way. So he's able to kind of think about how communities react to their environment, because you can measure environmental change. When you dig down, you also get pollen, you get animals, you can test bones and teeth and see what people were eating. And so he's thinking about how the environment is working and how the local society is managing all of these things. And that, frankly, is something I think everybody needs to be thinking about. Texas is ecologically sensitive. We need to know how to be resilient. And those ideas come from everywhere. So anybody that's got a good idea, including some community of Greek speakers in the Crimea 2,000 years ago, should be listened to. And he has an ear to the ground there. He can tell, he can see what's happening there and theorize and think about how they managed to deal with the changes that they were faced with. I think that's kind of the way that works when you look at an ancient society. One of the things you're doing is just learning some new tricks. Like, there's a lot of other things you're doing, but one of the things is, well, they did things this way. When I'm faced with my problems, can I come up with a solution based on what I learned looking at an ancient society?
That's very fascinating. Sarah, is there anything that you would like to add?
I could talk about the archaeological project that I worked on this
Absolutely,
summer.
Yeah.
My first time working on an archaeology project at Morgantina, which is another faculty-ran excavation. They started a new phase of the excavations called the Agora Valley Project, and this is in central Sicily. And the Agora Valley Project is examining a time period after Roman occupation in Sicily. So for most of the third century, you have Sicily kind of occupied by multiple powers. And then during the Punic Wars, Rome comes in and takes complete control of Sicily. And it's a turning point in which they're occupied under one power. So what's cool about the Agora Valley Project is that these centuries following the Roman control were kind of underrepresented or understudied because there's such a focus on the Hellenistic age in that island. So it's an exciting project because it's kind of digging in to get more context and reveal more about something that you might not have as much information recorded in literature, which is sort of what drew me to archaeology, because you can discover so many things that add context to a time period you're passionate about or enrich your understanding of it. Maybe like these subtle changes in religious practices that we can find from uncovering material remains weren't recorded, but now you have a whole new angle to the story. The daily life of the project was amazing, too. It was my first time going, so I was really nervous. I didn't know anything about archaeological methods besides what you can read, but I had never gained physical practice. And the team was so kind and supportive, and we had fun every day, even though it's like middle of summer, we're all very hot, it's a lot of physical labor, but it was a great place to learn. And it was a great time choosing a project and kind of getting into it, because every professor in our department was willing to talk to you.
I should say, in the defense of literature, so what we get to do, which the archaeologists don't get to do, is we get to go to these amazing libraries. So, you know, I spent time in the early part of my career in Rome because I needed to look at these codices. So these would be like 1,000-year-old, 1,200-year-old manuscripts that were in the Vatican Library. So I had, you know, I stayed in an apartment in Rome and got up in the morning, and every day I walked to the Vatican, showed my passport to get in. I went in through a back door because I was going to the library, not to St. Peter's. And then I went up, you know, upstairs, and I sat in the Vatican Library, and they brought me these 1,200-year-old manuscripts to look at. So it's kind of, it's more solitary. You don't have that, like that teamwork, but you still get the adventure. So, I mean, that was pretty amazing. There was a summer I spent in Berlin working on some papyrus fragments, which is a plant, and you hammer it flat in essence, and you get a really durable, stiff writing material. And then people threw it out. And in Egypt, because it's dry, when you throw out a piece of writing, it just sort of sits there. And so at the beginning of the 20th century, people started just taking, they had these dumps, and they just took all the papyrus with all the writing out of the dumps, and they're collected in libraries all over the place. So I was working on a fragment of a history from about the first century CE, so about 1900 years old, which was kept in the what's called the Pergamon Museum in Berlin, which is a museum which has the frieze of the altar of Pergamon, which has this massive monumental depiction of the Battle of the Gods and Giants on it, which you've probably seen if you've taken a Greek art history class. And the Germans just took it from where it was in Pergamon, which is Asia Minor, and set it up in this library. And right next to it was the Miletus Market Gate, which they also took from Asia Minor and set up in the library. And I would get there at 9 o'clock in the morning, 3 hours before the library, before the museum was open. So you have the ability to appreciate these things quite deeply. You get access at a completely different level. And then you know, it's a pretty amazing thing when somebody hands you, this happened to be for the first time in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, when somebody hands you, in my case, it was just a little cup, just a small cup about this big, which was 2,000 years old. And I had to put on some gloves, but after the gloves were on, I was in a room and they just handed me. I was like, are you crazy? This was amazing. And then you can look at it from all sides and draw. And yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And in the department, there's so many things you can explore. I was sort of mainly focusing on archaeology, but there's amazing philologists and historians or people who analyze ancient scripts. So there's definitely room to explore all of your talents, or not all of your interests.
Yeah, and one thing that really fascinates me, especially, you know, like in archaeology, is, I don't know, you're essentially a detective and you're peeling back these layers of earth to see, okay, does this line up with what we've, you know, maybe previously thought? You get to challenge these notions and sort of you're taking what you're finding and from that extrapolating facts.
Yeah, so that's... One doesn't want to convert everything into information all the time, but just for the sake of argument, just imagine that what we all do is we find information. Like at some point, some information was left for us, and then we draw our conclusions from it. And it could be written, or it could be, you know, it could be bones, or it could be earthworks, or it could be often, could be an inscription on a stone or something like that. At different times, different groups of people somehow, for some reason, become associated with some channel. So they control the channel. And this really does kind of happen in the ancient world, where everybody who's writing in Greek in a way that we have access to it in a medieval manuscript, so poets, historians, philosophers, lawyers, they reflect a particular shared culture, and that culture is probably mostly elite. So when you look at that body of evidence, what you get is a picture of Greek elite culture. If you look at the writing that you pull out of garbage dumps in Egypt, there you see some literature, but you also see contracts, you see marriage contracts, letters. There are letters from like students to their parents saying, send me these books because my teacher wants me to read them. And there you get a completely different picture, because that channel is different, right? You have just a different access to different kinds of things. And I would say that that's probably what is so crucial about having archaeologists inside the Department of Classics and working with literary people at the same time, is that what you find when you're doing that kind of work is a totally different worldview. So they're often... the best information about what classicists call non-elites, we could just call them regular people, enslaved people, you know, anybody who's not writing a book, gets to us archaeologically one way or another. So you get a much richer picture if you're able to put all those things together, which we are able to do because, you know, because we're amazing.
Absolutely, you're amazing. And talking about all of this, do you ever think, I guess later on down the road, like, what are people going to find from us almost? Like, you're talking about, you know,
you went through this dump
and you found all these pieces of papyrus, and it's just like makes me think like, well, what information am I throwing away that somebody, you know, maybe 2,000 years down the road is going to uncover?
Yeah, well, the thing is, what you want to be careful of is, what information am I keeping that somebody's going to be able to find? We have on campus the Ransom Center, which has all of these. It has manuscripts, letters, notebooks, drafts of an unbelievable, I mean, it really is an extraordinary collection of material, mostly modern, mostly 20th century writers. But it has their drafts, their letters, all kinds of things that you can imagine. And so UT actually purchased a lot of that material from authors, but sometimes those collections go into libraries after the author has passed away, and it's the inheritors who have to dispose of all that material. And I worry on a regular basis about my notebooks. So this is really old-fashioned, but I actually do a lot of my work with a pen and a notebook, not on a computer screen. And I am mostly wrong for long periods of time when I'm working on a project, like just wrong. And because I'm trying to come up with what the right idea is, I'm doing research, I'm learning, I don't have enough information, or I haven't quite learned how to see a problem correctly. And I make notes. My notes are just full of mistakes. But they don't make it into the final product. They're just there in my notes. My notebooks are all in my bookshelf, right? And I have shame about my mistakes, like most people do. They have shame about their mistakes. And so I do actually worry in a really specific way about, like, when am I going to get rid of these notebooks? Because I don't want people to be breaking in and finding out just how wrong I was before I was right.
Yeah. I think about that too. Or what if, like, your notebooks are the only preserved information of that topic, and then future historians just get it wrong because they're going on that or something. But now so many notes are online, or so many assignments are online. It's such a question of if everything is going to be perfectly preserved, or if it's all just going to be lost. Like, if you can't hold on to those electronic documents.
Yeah, that's it. I was just about to bring that up. I believe, you know, our parents were very much pen to paper type people. And now we have this generation where everything's technology, even our textbooks. You get the ebook now. And I very much was a pen to paper sort of girl, kind of like holding out. But what do you think about that?
I think, what are you going to do when the lights go out?
Exactly.
That's what I think. I once heard somebody actually say that, or what, just the Kindle had just come out. And so this must have been like 2010 or something. The Kindle had been around, but not for long enough for anybody to have sort of thought deeply about what ebooks meant. And I was at a panel and they were talking about philology, which is what we call study of literature in the age of the ebook. And one of the panelists said, the thing about a book is it still works. It still works when the lights go out. And all the young people thought it was the stupidest thing they'd ever heard. They were like making fun of it. And I was, oh, I don't know. Lights go out. We know this, right? We know lights go out. And yeah, that's what I think. I think that is short-term information from a certain perspective. Like, you need to know a lot, and you need to be very organized as a society before you can access that material. So when a long time from now, our social structure no longer works, if somebody finds a hard drive, they need a lot. They don't just need to be able to know the languages that whatever the information is written in. They need to know how to power the thing. They need to have all the right peripherals. None of that is non-trivial, whereas a piece of papyrus with some scribbles on it is a much simpler, much more durable kind of information. So that's actually really interesting. Like, we've talked about papyrus and books and bones. We haven't talked about inscription on stone. So there's a lot of writing on stone from the ancient world. And that stuff just sits there. And sometimes it's very hard to read, but sometimes it's crystal clear and it requires no maintenance. It just kind of sits there. You just stumble upon it and write it down, and then you can work with it.
Yeah, and I think, I guess that's sort of like the beauty of classics. I think our society now is so technology driven that we sort of are losing the appreciation for how things were done.
What you see in a department like classics, in addition to the scientific stuff, like, we are studying ancient cultures and all of us are trying to think about them without judgment in a methodologically responsible scientific way. But we're also kind of involved in a curatorial project where we're concerned to make sure that this material is still available to the next generation. And that's partly protecting libraries, making sure the libraries are clean and safe and not moldy, and partly making sure that this material is available in other media. So getting it into digital form is something that we do. We have a specialist in digital humanities in the department. We have people who work on something called photogrammetry, which I believe involves using a camera to convert things that are out there into the world into 3D digital models. We're concerned with making sure that the material is available in some other form. And when we teach language, we're making sure that the ability to understand the material is alive in the next generation. I mean, there is a kind of a we're uploading information into new minds when we teach Latin and Greek to people. So that's like, that's also part of the project, is keeping knowledges going so that the lights don't go out catastrophically.
Well, I guess there is a light at the end of the tunnel.
Another thing that I was reading about in my research of the classics department was the ancient music performance lab.
Let me tell you about the lab, and then I'll make some non-verbal sounds. The ancient music and performance lab is actually my lab, and it's a kind of a space and a platform and an opportunity to think about ancient performance art. So my specific areas of interest are Greek tragedy and ancient Greek music. And in the lab, the sort of the mission of the lab is not so much to reconstruct, but to think about the opportunities that these art forms provide to us. So how can one perform a stretch of dialogue in a Greek tragedy in a compelling way? One of our grad students, Lane Flores, is interested in how choruses, like how 10 or 12 people could dance together in a coherent way without there being choreography in advance. So we do things like that. And then because I do music, I mess around with musical instruments, which is what I brought. I brought an ancient lyre. I really think about, like, what does the lyre mean? It's partly about learning how to play it, but also just sort of thinking about opportunities for thinking and acting it provides. So I thought I would just tune this instrument. For those of you out in podcast land, this is a 7-string lyre. And you can tune the 7 strings any way you like. It's almost in tune right now. So the ancient Greek word for tuning was harmonia, which is just harmony. So I have 7 strings, and I want to get them into harmony with each other. And if I'm an ancient Greek in a world with a cell phone, which has a tuner on it, which will do it for me digitally immediately without any trouble, I got to use my ears. This is actually really hard because I'm 50 and my ears have started to change and I don't hear upper partials as well as I used to, which makes it hard for me to hear some of these intervals, but we're going to give it a shot. The basic idea here is that I can hear some intervals well. So I can hear that certain things sound good easily, and then I can adjust to make things sound good. So I'm supposed to be able to hear this interval, well, it's not quite right, easily. Those might be the first two notes of Amazing Grace. Amazing Grace, right? Da, da. So I should be able to get those two to get close. And we're going to say that's close enough. Yeah, that's pretty good. And then this is the other interval I'm supposed to hear. The first two notes of the Star Wars theme, the good guy Star Wars theme. Can you hear it? Da 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 da, right? That's going to be the wrong note, but you're going to da 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 da. So using those two intervals, I should be able to tune all 7 notes of this lyre. And if I put that together, I get something that sounds pretty good. Even if I just like play all the notes together, it doesn't sound bad. So harmony in ancient Greek was also the word for social harmony. So in a city, you've got all kinds of different people, rich, poor, free, enslaved, Greek speakers, non-Greek speakers, even in a place like Athens, lots of folks from elsewhere living in Athens. And they use this idea of all these different notes sounding good together as a metaphor, basically, for thinking about social harmony. So things are going well when we're in tune with each other. And then when you get Greek philosophy in the 4th century BCE, a philosopher like Plato says, virtue is just your soul in harmony with itself. So you can figure out how to tune your soul the way one tunes a lyre with only a couple of tools. That sounds good and that sounds good. That could be social and psychological well-being. I'm going to do one more thing with this. So this is like what we think about in Ample, Ancient Music and Performance Lab. I have a tuning on this lyre. But I might want to change it, right? So I don't know if you can hear this. That doesn't sound good. That sounds like a bad interval. So hidden inside of this harmonic, nice-sounding tuning, there's an interval that's not so nice. I just made it nice, right? Can you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
But the result is that I have a tuning. Sounds completely different. See what I'm saying? So just by working with this tool, I can get not just one harmony out of an instrument, but actually, as it turns out, seven. I won't take you through the whole cycle, but I can get seven different tunings just using that tool. So you have a harmony, but then you have a harmony of harmonies inside the instrument. So it's just a... What people can't see is it's a fake turtle shell, two pieces of wood, and seven strings sort of strung up in the middle. So it's a very simple piece of technology, but not only do I get to make pretty music with it, but I'm also thinking about my soul and how it can be better, and also my society and how that can be better, which is fun, right? All right, so I'll put it away.
Yeah, I would say fun to say the least. Mind-blowing would be a more accurate description.
It's beautiful, too. They can't see it, but it's a beautiful instrument.
Yeah, this instrument was made for me by an Italian maker by the name of Marco Sciascia, S-C-I-A-S-C-I-A, and he does unbelievably good work, and that is a... spectacular. It's truly a beautiful instrument. And it's a performer's instrument. I have other lyres that are also playable, but this one, you know, when you pick up a good one, it wants to be played. It talks back, and this one does that. It's a really musical object.
Yeah, the podcast doesn't do it justice.
So playing that is called experimental archaeomusicology, in case you were wondering. It's not just messing around with toys. It's experimental archaeomusicology. Because we're experimenting and we're doing archaeomusicology.
And it's fascinating to bring that part to life, because I feel like you lose so much when you're slowly translating through Greek tragedy, but to have scholars trying to recreate how, you know, these things would be performed in their own time kind of brings the magic of it back.
Oh yeah, it definitely breathes life. It definitely breathed life into this room for sure. It was breathtaking. That was beautiful.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I love that instrument.
We could do all seven tunings, and I would sit here just happily. But moving on to the underlying reason that I'm doing this is combating the stereotype that liberal arts is more of an impractical degree path, and that we are all starving artists. I know that when I told my family that I'd gotten into the University of Texas, they were blown away. They were so proud. And then I told them, by the way, I've got accepted into the College of Liberal Arts. The excitement was dampened, and they sort of looked at me like, well, what are you going to do with that? I guess the common notion now is like STEM or business or more like lucrative degrees. And I feel like liberal arts is just kind of getting the cold shoulder. Have y'all encountered the same stigma? And how do you defend College of Liberal Arts?
Sure. I have encountered that, especially I feel like in recent years. Where I'm from, it's a very like STEM scientific community. So it can feel intimidating to be pursuing liberal arts. But I think it's such an important discipline because it's part of what makes us human, and it's this beautiful part of our life. And if we talk about ancient societies, from the beginning of time, we've been having this desire to make art and record history. And I think it's quite rewarding to study and to keep those skills about and to keep passing down this history. And as far as practicality and jobs, I think that UT does a great job of helping you explore those options. And within classics and a lot of liberal arts, there's a lot of places you can take it. I know so many fellow majors who have different ideas if they want to keep pursuing academia or if they want to use their undergrad to do law school or to do museum studies. You can really build so much upon that solid foundation, and classics gives you so much of that foundation because you are not just studying history, but multiple languages at once and art history. And if you're exploring scientific sides of archaeology, it'd be like bioarchaeology or like GIS systems. It's such a well-rounded discipline that you can take it any direction you wish. And at UT, there's the community that's going to help you do that. So I think it's so much more rewarding to pursue something you're passionate about and that there are avenues you can take that may not be as conventional as, you know, going to medical school, but the community here is going to help you do that.
Yeah, that's a good answer. So I think for a lot of people, and this was true of me, and I'm sure it's still true, the subjects, the humanities, the liberal arts were there for us before we went to college. So I was a black sheep. My father's a biochemist. My mother has a graduate degree in physiology. My uncle's a physicist. My brother actually is also a kinesiologist, teaches in the university. So I come from they're all scientists. I had a strong affinity from really early on towards music and the arts. I was a reader. I liked to sing. I was in rock bands in high school. I just wasn't going in that direction. And because universities had programs in literature, programs in classics, I had a path through college. If that wasn't there, I wasn't going to college. That was my reality. And I don't think that I'm unique that way. And a lot of what we do is provide the opportunity for people who are disposed in that direction to acquire the discipline and the life skills and the resilience and the agility that you get from a college degree. I also got the, what are you going to do with that question? I don't think my answers were very good. My answer was, well, I'm going to teach other people this stuff, which in fact was the right answer. It's what I do now for a living. But I think that what I should have done was say, well, you know, this is who I am. and this is what I'm going to be one way or another. And I do believe that what college gives to you has value, and part of what it does is it interfaces with who you are and your talents, strengths, and interests. Now let me answer your question, because I think that never gets said, and I think that's important. So I am in a position of leadership, what they call a position of leadership. It's actually more like middle management. I'm the chair of the classics department, so I am nominally responsible for making sure that this department offers its programs as it has to, that faculty are supported in doing their research, that we continue the tradition of really genuine excellence that this department has had for a very long time. And 90% of that is managing people. So I do have to be able to read a spreadsheet. It's helpful to be able to add, subtract, multiply, and divide. I have to be able to read some complicated legal type looking documents, but most of it is dealing with people, listening to people, solving problems between people. That's mostly what I do. And every single day I draw on something I've read in a classical text. Not like somebody comes into my office and says, I have a problem, I don't quote Euripides at them or say, you know, the ancient philosopher Seneca says this. That's not what I mean. What I mean is that dealing with people is emotional work. So you need to be predictable. You need to be calm. You need to keep the temperature more or less where it should be at a moderate level, not get too hot emotionally in the room. You need to be able to see your way towards solutions all the time, even when, as does occasionally happen, you're being yelled at or being corrected because you made a mistake. You still have to be able to keep your wits about you and see what's next. And the skills that I have to do that, to keep myself properly balanced in what is sometimes a challenging environment, come from classical texts. So in this case, they come mostly from ancient philosophy and from tragedy, which despite the fact that it's about people having terrible things happening to them all the time, actually contains a lot of really interesting negative examples. Like, I don't want to be like Oedipus, right? I don't want to be like Orestes or whatever. And I think that that part of my job is not that unusual. I mean, it's not just a university thing. Everybody who works with people, everybody who gets put in some kind of a position of leadership needs to display the characteristics that I just described. And we do teach people how to do that. There is training there in leadership.
Absolutely. And I would also vary to say that one thing that I would like to almost counter is people think that you go to college to get this degree or this piece of paper and say, you know, hey, I am certified, I am a professional. But I think college is more of the experience of finding yourself and finding your inner harmony, and also learning to think critically and write and find a passion. You know, our K through 12 education, it's very structured. There really is no room to explore, whereas you come to college and there is a basic structure. You have to take so many of these credits and you have to take, you know, this math class, but it's more of picking things that sort of speak to you and help you develop yourself. And I think that is very lost on a lot of people.
Yeah, so you start there with like an intuition about yourself or a vocation, and then you get a whole bunch of really solid, like really hard skills, like the writing you're talking about, the ability to kind of think through an argument, to perceive how an argument is put together, to see where an argument might not be working and to speculate about why, all of those things. And 4 years later, not only do you have those skills, which are emphatically marketable, but at the broader level, you come out of it more focused, more confident, more yourself, and more present in the world and to the people around you. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for that. We are coming towards the end of our time. So I just sort of wanted to get your favorite memory associated with the University of Texas, whether it being a student or a teacher or middle management. Maybe your defining UT moment was middle management.
Why don't you go first?
We have so many good moments, I think, within the club. You would think about, we have all these exciting plans to have these reading groups and reenact plays and host professors and lectures. But some of my favorite memories have been when we're just very burnt out. We all have a Greek test the next day. And like one meeting, we all decided to just do Just Dance. And it was so much fun. And we all came in there so stressed and left feeling like it's okay. Like we all have these finals. But so I guess those silly moments where a community of people come together that are usually have something very scholarly between them, but kind of like throw it up in the wind to have fun. And I think we have a good amount of those moments, but that Just Dance meeting comes to mind. And I don't know.
Maybe a dance meeting.
Silly one, but
I love that.
We can get involved. Ample, the lab can get involved. Next time you want to have a dance meeting, let me know. We'll teach you some ancient Greek dancing techniques.
That should be the next classics project. Yes. Doing a Just Dance, but with an ancient performance. I love that.
Yeah, we're working on it.
That's a million-dollar idea right there, guys. Yeah. You heard it first.
I think mine is probably in classroom. I taught Intro Greek last semester. So Intro Greek is an intro language course, so that's a slightly more demanding process for everybody involved. You meet once a day for an hour, 5 days a week. I mean, ideally, you do it for two semesters, and then you do another semester after that, and then you're off, and you can kind of read and start getting going. But going to class every day for an hour can get tiring. And when you're at the front of it, it's tiring for you as well as everybody else, because you're also there every day and you have to be 100%. You have to be totally there for the students. Just managing energy becomes a thing that you have to do. So I did it last semester with a smallish class. There was this moment when I realized everybody in this classroom is going to be okay at this. And what it was something like what you just described. So the atmosphere changed from a long slog, which is, you know, what it is. There's always more to memorize. Everything is conceptually difficult. And then one day the atmosphere just lightened and people started to have fun with it. And what had happened, I think, was my students in that class had gotten good enough at the basic stuff that the new stuff was going down more easily. And they were starting to play with it. And you don't get to see undergrads start to play with language concepts in intro language courses very often. And that room became quite playful. There's a lot of laughing. And I really enjoyed that. I think that the very high quality of student that UT has, and people here are just smart and they work hard, and then just luck, some kind of chemistry in that room made it a great experience. Yeah, that's what I would say.
And both very great experiences. Thank you so much for sharing that. I would like to thank you both very much for taking the time out of your day to do this with me. I would just maybe just behalf of all of the classic students to be, thank you. I really appreciate y'all, and hook 'em.
Hook 'em.
Hook 'em. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks.